This is Thought Crime. I am your host, Wesley Fox, collector and editor of PressingSciFi.com. And for this episode number 37, I have with me Retzi Bruno, author of Titanborn, to talk. We're going to talk about his new book, as maybe a few other things you never know. So why don't we just jump right into it. Rhett, thanks for joining me, and how are you doing?
Hey, man. Good to be here. I'm doing good. It's a nice night. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good. The weather down here has gone from jungle 95 degrees to something that's a lot more pleasant, and so it's much nicer down here nowadays. And also been switching more since we're getting almost into the fall season. I've switched to beer a little bit more lately, so that's kind of more my thing.
Yes, same here.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I love fall, mostly for beer.
Yeah, the Oktoberfest brews are my favorite. Love Oktoberfest. All right, so Titanborn is number three that you have out, correct? Is that the third novel? Because I know you have some short stories, so would this be the third novel length? Or
of my science fiction and more recently published stuff, yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's right. You do a few other things. Okay. Well, did Titanborn go differently than your previous works, or has your process changed, or was this kind of roughly this, it was like one of the ideas in your head and you just finally had a chance to write it, or I don't know, just take me through, like, did it go a little differently this time?
Yeah, it was actually very, very different. I know, because with The Circuit, that was always a planned trilogy of books, I had an outline and all the characters outlined. It was all pretty detailed with like some surprises here and there as I was writing, but the overall story, I always knew where it was going to go. Whereas Titanborn was really just an idea I had for a short story that I wrote. And mostly the short story focused more on the relationship between the main character, who's a bounty hunter, and the off-worlders who he has to deal with. And I wrote it because I was on like a kick of writing short stories and submitting them to magazines. And that one wound up, the short story just kind of kept going, and it wound up being too long. It was like 19,000 words, which means there's like three places you could submit that length to. And they all got back to me and said no, so I kept writing other stuff. But I just always had more ideas for it of how it could become a novel. So like, literally, usually it takes me a little longer to write a novel, but I kind of sat down and took that short story and rewrote it as a novel, adding in all the ideas I had after the short story was already done. And by the end of it, I had like a 50,000 word manuscript that I felt was probably the best written thing that I'd ever done, but I wasn't sure what to do with it. And so I took a chance. I sent it out to some agents, because really it was novella length at that point, which made it a tough sell for agents. And one of them got back to me that he really, really liked it, but he was not sure about the novella. So we sat down, not really over the phone, but talked about maybe how I could expand it, turn it into a novel. And I understood what he was saying. I mean, it's a lot more markets open up, and being a relatively unknown author at the time, I think that was a better idea than being limited to a couple markets here and there. So I went through the story, looked at where I could build upon it. We sent it to a bunch of people, and a few of the publishers came back positive, but one with Del Rey really, really liked it. She was a younger editor just starting out with Del Rey. She liked it but wanted a little more action, so again I had to do a little bit of editing, and now that I've done all that changing to the story, I can't imagine it really any other way, because mostly all the editing, what it did was expand on the side character of Zeph, who's Malcolm's partner. He's the main character, and it was mostly about building that relationship, because that's what the editor loved. And so I wound up with a Random House Hydra, which is a branch of Random House. It was close to Del Rey, not there yet, but yeah, so it was much different than the circuit, not even only in just how I wrote it and how long it took and the different phases it took on, but also like submitting it. It wasn't me submitting it. It was very different with an agent. Kind of, I was just sitting in the background waiting for things to happen. So it's definitely been a very different experience.
Yeah, kind of. I guess it helps when someone there is to help you out with some of the things that either you're not particularly good at or you don't want to do. I guess, I mean, that's the case for me. The going out there and trying to get someone to read it and get someone to buy it. An agent definitely helps. At least I've been told. I have not secured an agent yet, but I've been told for it kind of lifts a lot of weight off what authors try to do when they first start off and they're more or less either self-publishing or just trying to get something out there.
It definitely helps, but it's also nerve-wracking, like being totally out of the loop. You know, they're really not supposed to tell you much about the submissions or any feedback or anything. So you're kind of just like in the dark for 2 months and then get a whole bunch of emails of good news or bad news at any time. So that's the one difference. But yeah, it's nice having someone supporting your work and putting it out there for you.
Well, this sounds like it was like more of an evolutionary thing instead of you wrote a manuscript and then you ran around to sell it. You actually, this started off as a smaller piece and kind of grew, so to speak, and evolved. And that is interesting. It's really, and I did read, you sent me before, like some of the, I don't know if I want to call supplemental, but stories that are set in the same universe and kind of supporting cast stories of Trass, the billionaire. Well, I'm going to ask you to summarize, but there's kind of like a prequel short story you worked on, and then there was also something on one of the peripheral characters, which I'm assuming might play a bigger role if there's a sequel. So I guess when I read it, I got kind of more of a fuller picture, and it is like when I read it, it was much more alive and much more real than when you first sent it to me as a novella about a year ago. It was a little bit more, I was still trying to put together the pieces, but this was like just, I don't know, maybe I'm biased because I'd already read it, so it was very clear to me. But how about you? Yeah, if you could just maybe summarize what Titanborn's about.
Yeah, so basically the quick summary is that Malcolm Graves is an old-time collector, which is a name for the bounty hunters that work for the large corporations who are pretty much running the solar system at this time in the future. And he's been at it for 30 years and is starting to slow down, even though he won't admit it. And really the story is about him coming to terms with his mortality when he's partnered up with a really young, obviously more skilled than him partner. And they're sort of thrust into what seems like, you know, a normal investigation for him. And it becomes a much bigger deal involving actual revolution on one of these off-world colonies, whereas he's usually putting down strikes and riots, you know, things you would imagine on an off-world colony with people who aren't making as much money as they thought they would.
Yeah.
And now he's dealing with a clash of cultures where these new off-worlders sort of, they see their world as their world, not Earth anymore. They have kind of evolved beyond Earth. And that's what it's about. It's really him coming to terms with what he's been spending his whole life doing, whether or not chasing money and as a bounty hunter has been the best life choice for him.
So it's kind of like the whole solar system or the whole universe is starting to pass him by, not just professionally, but kind of what's just, you know, things aren't the same anymore on. And I think that's, and the colony in question is Titan, right? The moon of Saturn?
Yeah, it's the moon of Saturn. So the background of the story is that 300 years before it, a meteor hit Earth and was like a near extinction event. And during that time, one ship filled with people went to Titan and settled there. And then 250 years later, the survivors of Earth and the people who've really started a whole new civilization on Titan reconnect, and the germs from Earth really devastate the Titan population. And whether that was on purpose or an accident is really always up for question in all of the books that are coming. And that's a big thing for the people that live on Titan, which they're called Titanborn, hence the name of the book. And that that rift right there is what Malcolm winds up in. And he's, as someone who's really dealt with people only caring about money, there's sort of a moment when he sees sort of a suicide in the name of a cause, where he's just confused that anyone would be willing to die for anything like that, because this is sort of your grim future world where everyone's really out for themselves because of that meteor. It's sort of survival is the most important thing to everybody, because the meteor kind of changed the way humanity looks at everything. We're expanding to survive.
Okay. So, and I guess, yeah, the two things that like when I was reading this is the germ, the immunity issue, which I remember. I mean, I'm a history buff, so the first thing I think of is the diseases that the conquistadors and colonists brought to the North America, in particular Cortez, where they managed to conquer, you know, the Aztecs and Mexicans, the Mexican peoples at the time, without really killing any of them or shooting any of them. The diseases just ran rampant, and it was kind of an unintended consequence. And I think it was, and I was, I guess in the book you mentioned that the reason that their immunity is off is that they've been living in a sterilized habitat for 300 years, and obviously the population is a lot smaller. So a lot of the, and they did not bring a lot of the microbes and pathogens from Earth. So they have had 300 years to basically lose some of the immunities that kind of we take for granted. Is that kind of roughly what was happening there, or?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the gist of it. They only brought really what they needed, because germs wouldn't be an issue living on Titan. And then when they finally make contact with Earth again, and both of them reunite on Titan, which is not something you ever see in the novel, that it happens before it ever starts. But that's really what kicks off the awful situation on Titan, where everyone who lived there before, really, they call it a plague. It's not really the same as a plague, but all these sicknesses that for people on Earth were no problem came and just ravaged the new civilization on Titan, and it allowed Earth corporations to really take control of it immediately. And so that culture, yeah, that Titan culture that developed over those 250 years dies in like an instant. So that's a little bit of what you see in the first book, and more of what you'll see in the sequel, Titanborn sequels that are coming out.
Yeah. So Titan is a very unique colony, and it's not really a colony, as you're saying here. It's its own kind of, it's kind of become its own sovereign world. But like Mars, and I think in the book mentions that we are now colonized the moon, Mars, some of the moons of Jupiter, and so we are kind of a system-wide civilization now. But every other colony came from Earth after post meteor. So this is basically Titan and everyone else. And it's kind of like this weird, it had 300 years to kind of develop its own subculture, whereas everything else was basically a descendant of what was left of. So that was, I mean, it's so much clearer in this book. I'm not sure, maybe because I was reading it a second time, but that kind of conflict. And I think also when I read the part where this guy, the self-immolation, he blows himself up. I mean, nowadays, you know, we're all kind of, that doesn't really shock us because of the events of the last 15 years. But so what you're saying here is like after the meteor, like the terror, and in this world, terrorism and kind of suicide bombings are kind of considered a relic of history. It's obviously no longer part of our civilization.
Yeah, well, the whole idea, which Malcolm, and you're inside of his head, so his whole idea is that after the meteorite, suicide is kind of like an antiquated thing, because survival has become this great focus, and really Earth's only goal is to expand beyond Earth so that there could never be an extinction event like that ever again. That's their manifest destiny. That's their goal. They don't care where they're going. They just want colonies everywhere, and you know, Titan sort of is in the way.
And Titan is kind of there's a lot of like resources that are now being collected or extracted from Jupiter, Saturn. This is the other reason. That's kind of the impression I got, that the other reason that we beat that, and also this is what a lot of thinkers today say. I mean, Stephen Hawking and others have said that we need to colonize another planet for no other reason, just to ensure that the species can endure a extinction event, like you said. But yeah, the other reason is that there are resources, rare metals in the asteroid belt, possibly on Mars, and also the gases that are in Saturn and Jupiter that are of value. And so is Titanborn also like one of these places where it's considered like a valuable location?
So maybe not exactly in real life. I mean, I did as much research as I could, but in the context of the story, Titan and the ring, which is what they call Saturn and all of its moons, is the most valuable location in the whole solar system. Basically, you have unlimited water in the ring of Saturn. Mm-hmm. It's way more flush with the needed gases than Jupiter. There's unlimited fossil fuels on Titan, methane lakes and all that. So it's really, it has everything you could want except for a habitable environment. And most importantly, it has an atmosphere. So it doesn't need giant domes like on Mars. It kind of just, they build these enclosures that cover everything up, but they're actually able to look outside and they're protected from the sun. So it really is a very valuable planet that all they need to do is figure out how to cool it down, and it'll be much easier to take advantage of the atmosphere and sort of start living under less thick enclosure. So everyone wants Titan, and that's the reason they had went there when the meteor was coming in the first place. And the idea in the story is that Jupiter is starting developed. Titan is more developed, obviously, because people were already there. So that was the goal of the company that first met up with the people on Titan.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They didn't need to work as hard because that moon and the other moons were already settled. So Jupiter is sort of starting to build up, because right now Earth is just starting to really build Mars up and they're moving on to Jupiter, you know, sort of taking our steps through the solar system. And that's what Titan, it's almost like the Middle East with oil in the book, because it has the gases needed to power all the ships that go to the solar system.
I've read a little bit about where, you know, where, because this is actually becoming a thing in a growing number of kind of space operas. Instead of like this faster than light, we're going to be jumping between stars, a lot of people are starting to read and contemplate a lot more about what, where we could be living right in our own solar system, even with the challenges of terraforming, because there is no Earth-like planet really aside from Venus.
Yeah.
But Mars and Titan, I know, has been mentioned for the reasons you just mentioned as a key location. And I think it is kind of like that thing where it's whether it's the Middle East, it's like that one place that everyone wants to go because it's easy to develop. And like you said, that's a very cool like take on that, because it's really, for one thing, it's Titan. It's not the nearest place. They didn't go to Mars. They didn't go to Moon. They went way out, and that's why it took so long for the established. I mean, I don't know. I just thought that was very cool. Now that the timeline after I read this was clear in my head, I just thought that was very fascinating. And so we have Malcolm Graves, who is a collector. That's his job. Can you explain a little bit like what a collector is, like roughly?
So basically he works for Prevenio Corp, which they're the largest corporation in the solar system right now, because they were the ones who organized the reunion with Titan. And because of then the sickness, they were the ones who now run Titan and most of the moons around Saturn. So they run the gas trade and they own this wealthy colony planet. So they're really on top in the corporation world. And Malcolm has been a collector for them, which is, aside from being someone who directs things, it's like their highest militant position in their secret private military, really. I mean, it's not openly a military, but they have their officers. It's your typical, you know, futuristic corporation in any future book. But so basically as a collector, it's his job to handle their situations. So dealing with strikes, riots, and it's not always killing someone. is not always capturing someone. He's almost an enforcer.
Okay, so I kind of thought of him. So he's not like. So I guess like in kind of these things, corporations have their own private security forces to deal with regular things. So he's not the rent-a-cop, but he's not an executive. So he's kind of. I guess the word I kept thinking of is like he's like a high level operative. He's like the or the cleaner. Level, highly capable person. He's not just a soldier. He's a guy that just goes in and gets things done, and they kind of invest him with all sorts of authority once he gets there to work with the rent-a-cops and whatnot. Collector though? Where did you come up with like to call him a collector?
Mostly, I mean, he's collecting bounties. There's a bounty on every job he does. Okay. And I really wanted to place focus on his focus on credits, which is the money that they use. And like, really when the book starts, it's all he cares about. And then as it goes along, you start to see more inside of him and what he really cares about. But I wanted to bring focus to that. Really all he's after is the money, and he's going to take care of these jobs for Perennial Corp, no matter what they are, without asking, as long as he gets them.
So he is a like technically maybe on paper a company man, but the point is that these kind of people they're more like maybe a mercenary type where they're collecting this for the money. They don't really give two shits about the corporate politics or any of that. They're just there to solve problems and get paid.
Yeah, he's not involved in that, but he is directly an employee of that company. So there is some tension with people in their rival company that you see in the book, but it's mostly just a kind of competitive, not really that he cares what they did to their company a long time ago. He just wants, you know, he wants to be the best collector and get all the best jobs out there because there's a competition to cover things up. It's a lot of corporate espionage going on because technically there is a government on Earth that is really run behind the scenes by these corporations who are running the expansion out into the solar system, which is what all anybody really cares about.
Malcolm Graves has kind of this worn out detective kind of vibe to him, the way he speaks and kind of the way he operates. Were you kind of influenced by like noir detective stories or kind of some of these, I mean, not really police procedurals, but kind of like these classic shows with these kind of older cops that are still just, you know, fighting the good fight. But in this case, he's more of a bounty hunter / mercenary. Did you kind of take that into account or kind of take when building Malcolm Graves?
That was definitely the influence. I mean, it was a lot of Rick Deckard from Blade Runner in him, but really pushed to the extreme with how tired he is and how worn down. I mean, he's been doing it for so long. That's why he can't really let it go. He's almost hooked. He's like an addict.
Well, yeah, that's that vibe and that kind of part of him definitely comes through right from the start. He's like this older kind of washed up cop. I mean, he's still effective in the story, but he does kind of remind me of these older washed up cops that are hunched over a bar with a drink and they're divorced and they can't see their kid. And so some of these other details kind of match up. And that's definitely the feeling. And he just doesn't care about the world. He's just trying to get through the day and get to the next bounty or the next job. I kind of imagined him, like you said, Eric Rick Deckard. I kind of imagine him as John McClane or Bruce Willis.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if he's that effective of a soldier. At least you don't really see him in that kind of level. Maybe in his prime.
Yeah. When he was younger.
I think maybe he's one of those guys like 10 years after the last movie, just really struggling to get through the job, but doing it anyway.
Maybe some of the Clint Eastwood police ones when he's older and he has, because there is a movie, I can't remember the name now, but he's an older detective and he has to take on a new partner, and the new partner's Charlie Sheen. It's an 80s cop movie, but there's like a lot of cop movies where the older, experienced, effective detective is forced to take a younger partner. And that's kind of like what I saw here with Zaff. But if Zaff is like not really a typical, fresh out of the academy, he's a, I guess he's a conditioned, he has some, it sounds like he has some cybernetic enhancement, but it seems like he's more or less a conditioned operative or collector. Is that right?
What he is, and some people have asked if he's a robot, which I'll clear, he's not a robot.
Okay.
That level of technology has not been advanced because in this book they're focused on expansion, so it's travel and not robotics. So that's sort of fallen to the wayside. But Zeph really and explains a little bit in the book, but again, it's from Malcolm's perspective, so you only see what he sees. But basically, Zaf is part of a group called the Kojin Initiative, where the people in charge at Prevenio Corp have taken kids basically with a really specific concoction of social disorders and Asperger's, that kind of stuff, and have used those talents and very intense conditioning basically to turn them into calculative super soldiers. Now he has his few enhancements, like with his eye that allows him to scan and see things, see thermal and all that stuff. But really what he is someone who's completely socially inept, who's been trained to read faces and situations, kind of just like a perfect strategist and know what people are thinking and what to do with it. So he's essentially just a super soldier, just not strength-wise.
Okay, and is he like naturally in these stories, like the older veteran is kind of threatened by his effectiveness, and in this case, you definitely see Zaf with these enhancements and this training and what he can do with his implant that he's a little threatened that he's being replaced. So is the Kojin Initiative kind of the corporation's way of replacing collectors? Is that kind of what?
Yeah,
Because
it's
there is
the
some.
new.
They start to, I mean, they do kind of develop some chemistry with each other, but like right off the bat, when I was reading that, I was like, he has to pair up with his own replacement. Like it was like, man, at some point he's just gonna accidentally shoot him, you know?
Yeah, it's there's sort of like the next wave of collectors who really won't ask questions, who don't really care about being paid because they've been had all of that conditioned out of it. So less the mercenary, I want money type, and more the I'll do whatever you ask, I won't ask questions type. You know, and in the book they sort of hint that maybe it's best for them to be paired with someone who's really grown up like a human and still has emotion, rather than these Kojins who really have had the emotion drained out of them, their care for other people drained out of them, and all they really care about is accomplishing their job. They almost are like robots. So yeah, there's a lot of tension between them, but I think as the book goes along, they and also his boss sort of see how well they can work together to mix both of the polar opposites together.
Yeah, that was really what was starting to develop towards the second half. It was no longer a competition. There was certain things that one of them can do and certain things that the other one could do because of Malcolm Graves' just innate understanding of human nature and his ability to speak to people. Zaf, of course, could not, you know, stands out everywhere he goes and has no means of, you know, talking himself past any gatekeeper. And so that was a very kind of as it wore on. You know, I mean, it is kind of similar to some of these police procedurals where you have like, you know, the young guy and the old guy start to actually get along. Like Lethal Weapon is kind of another one I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Except this one is definitely, you know, 500 years in the future or 300 years or whatever you have. There's a kind of a sad, kind of tragic element to it because of Zaf's origins and also a little bit of Malcolm Graves' origins. So, like personally, it was yeah, obviously a little bit darker than that was my.
Yeah, which was what I was going for. I wanted to like cue into something mainstream and then put my own twist with it, with the setting and the characters, basically more their backgrounds, where they came from. And it's sort of as you go through the book and Malcolm like uses all his old connections, it's almost like a tour through the ghosts of his past. And he, like, not even by any fault of his own, has to come to terms with a lot of things that have happened to him over 30 years, and maybe like almost 30 years worth of him just bottling up his emotions are forced to come out based on who he's meeting. And Zaf is right there along for the ride with him. So it is a It's a nice arc for both of them.
Yeah, it is the and as they're going, like there's kind of two parallels here, which I kind of liked, and I really wish more, especially with writers when they I get I'm speaking as a reader here. When I read science fiction, there's a lot of they either do a lot of world building and not so much with the characters, or they put everything on the characters and they put no thought into the world building, and really like the best books I've read do like parallels where you're actually seeing kind of similarities in what's going on with the main characters with also what's going on in the background. And like you said, this is, there's for him, like there, he's kind of going over his life and seeing, you know, through just through the people he has to meet and the places he has to go. But also he's, you know, he's been just largely disinterested and not really paying attention to the big picture. And not only is he kind of taken by surprise by what happens, but it seems like the whole solar system is shocked by what what's happening with these Titanborns.
Titanborn. And it's kind of, I mean, this. You could go.
No, I guess the way to sum it up is like there seems to be like there's a war coming, but nobody really saw it happening because everyone was just kind of doing their day to day, you know, get the money business. They weren't paying attention to the kind of thing that was festering out on Titan. And so Malcolm Graves and Prevenio, the corporation, are both kind of surprised by what happens at the end. And I thought that was a very cool kind of intertwining of the character's arc and also the broader story arc.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, it does build in to additional novels, which one of which is finished and will be coming out, and the other that I'm writing now, where, yeah, you definitely hit it right on the head. I mean, it was not expected by anyone because no one was really paying attention. They sent their collectors in, they ended riots and stuff, but what happens when it was something bigger than a riot? What happens when is a cultural movement? And this isn't an Earth that's built on war. It's an Earth built on everyone really working together to survive and to expand. So they don't really have any training with revolution or war or any real battle at all. And so when really these terrorists on one side but freedom fighters on the other come out, no one knows what to do about it. And then they send Malcolm in, and it's not anything he's ever dealt with before either. And I think that's a lot of what the sequel will deal with is how this revolution actually starts, because the books aren't about the revolution. They're really more about how it starts.
That's the impression. The other thing I noticed about this is your a lot of stories, especially recently, kind of use corporations as the authority structures, not governments, not presidents or bureaucracies or empires or emperors or whatever. Like there is like a vein of them that kind of use kind of old school hereditary, you know, we're going to go back to lords and houses, you know, like Dune. And then but more recently, I guess there's been just a more negative, and just more attention is being placed on how much authority or how much power corporations have in our society. I was wondering, I guess you've kind of already answered it. Like, is that going to be this kind of corporatism? Is that going to be a theme as we go along? Or are you kind of, is that kind of more of just the setting? And this is more of Earth versus Titan rather than corporations versus the little man? Because that was kind of another dimension that it didn't come out in this novel. But I feel like as I was finishing it, I was like, that seems like something that could come out later.
It'll in the sequel, it comes out big time. It's really the Earthers are represented by one corporation, and it's really them versus the people on Titan. That's the main focus. It's a new cast of characters, but it takes place at the same time. But by the third book, all the corporations are rivals with each other, but the people on Titan, once the revolution starts, they're enemies with everyone on Earth. So it's sort of a bunch of people fighting each other and fighting another person. It's kind of a mess because no one was expecting this to happen. And it is really the major like the goings on of the corporations will be in the background, because as Malcolm established, they live in a corporatocracy where there's a democracy on Earth that kind of run things and runs the policies that keep Earth going. But the corporations, and I never say how any of them were started, but there's hints here and there. Basically, the idea is these were people that after the meteor hit found themselves in positions of power. Those grew into big corporations, and the democracy doesn't really have any power itself beyond giving into those corporations. So it's not that the corporations are evil in this, which is what happens in a lot of science fiction, that it's the big bad corporations and everyone else against them. The corporations are Earth. They're just what has happened because all these private policies were the best way to expand fast, and it's just sort of what's happened because of the meteor.
Yeah, that would that for me, like, because I'm a little bit of a policy nerd, and I mentioned this in the review, and I've also mentioned this like a few other times in other podcasts. Like, that some people they use corporations as part of the setting, as part of their dystopia, or part of the structure, and then they don't really go into any real nuance. The corporation is just bad, and they just like being bad, and they, you know, as you know, and I kind of joke around sometimes, like from the puppet Tim Robbins and Team America, you know, that like they're all corporation-y and they make money, and there's like no real detail beyond that because they don't really try. And then in some of the other stories I've read, there is it's not really a corporation. It's basically the government that still, for whatever reason, calls itself a corporation, but it's basically the state. And I mean, you didn't do either of those things, actually. This is Prevenio and Vesta are part of, I mean, they're part of a working group, but there is a government, and they all have roles. And Vesta and Prevenio, unlike other stories I've read, actually have a business, an economic activity that they pursue. So they are still corporations. They are still extracting resources, selling it, and making profits. So it is something that I've noticed that more science fiction and have used it, and even kind of tech thrillers. I am kind of, and I said this in the review, your world building is very strong. Like, the detail in your world building is at the top level for the last few books I've read in sci-fi. And I think one of the reasons I did like it is that you didn't just use the corporations as a set piece for evil bad guys. They really are. They're not good people, but they're not, you know, sitting in dark rooms and rubbing their hands together and, you know, drinking puppy blood.
That was the main goal with Titanborn and all the books that'll come, is that not to make it black and white, not to ever have good guys. I mean, even in the sequel, when it's told from the perspective of one of the Titanborn people, like, these are our terrorists. They're acting like terrorists, but they have their own goals, and the corporations have their own goals, and they each view each other differently. One sees one as evil, one thinks they're doing the right thing. So I wanted to keep it more gray. And I mean, Malcolm was the perfect way to kick that off, because he's just cares about money. He's not really evil. He doesn't kill for pleasure. He only does what he has to make his living.
No, I never got the impression he enjoyed his job. You're absolutely right. Or I'm sorry, enjoyed the darker kind of harmful parts of his job, where people die or when people get hurt. He never really enjoys it.
He almost complains when they push him far enough to have to kill them. I think he enjoys the thrill of it, but he just wants things to run cleanly, wants things to go cleanly and make his job easier.
Absolutely. The other question I had, this is like I said, this is like a very, seems to me like a plausible future for humanity. Do you see like this, maybe not this exact scenario, but maybe I asked you about this for Progeny of Vale as well, because same thing, both of these books, both all of your books have a high level of plausibility and realism, you know, like you see like this could be the future. Do you kind of feel like is that what you're trying to convey here, or are you kind of, you wanted to make it plausible, but this is just to tell a story?
A little bit of both. For the circuit, definitely I didn't think that could actually happen, because there's some fantastical elements to that. For this, I kind of took the impact event of the meteorite and kind of spun from there of what I thought would probably happen based on human nature after that happened, which obviously the chances of that happening within our lifetime, which is when it happens in the book, being hit by a meteor that size and kind of reshuffling the way everything works, wouldn't really happen. But I wanted to take that awful apocalypse event and just take humanity from there. How would we evolve? Would there be a rich person who would try to start a colony and run from the event? I would imagine so. And then how would people respond to it? Well, in the book, they base their entire lives off of making sure a meteor can never wipe out humanity again, which were both the main premises of the setting and what I thought would be pretty feasible in real life too.
I see. So it's a plausible scenario, but you're not really trying to make any kind of social commentary with how it you structured it. This is more of just this is a possibility, and this is one way it could unfold. In other words,
yeah, definitely. I used the meteor to make sure that was clear, like, because that's shaking things up. If there was no meteor, then maybe, you know, I could have taken a more realistic approach. But the meteor kind of erases all of our countries and everything. It gave me a clean slate to just move forward with how I thought human nature would react to that situation.
Yeah, I bought it for the unification of it in the face of a near extinction event. It wasn't quite an extinction. But there is kind of a unification, as resources are shared in order to make sure the species survives. Trass is just one of these kind of, Bronson or Steve Jobs or Elon Musk kind of guys that just happen to have the resources and the knowledge and foresight to do something on his own. And I kind of noticed that we are living in an age where, like, more and more work is in space is being done by private corporations rather than NASA. And so I really did, if the meteor did hit, like, sometime in the next 20 to 30 years, I did kind of see what you put together here. You know, the government's still trying to get their act together, and then one person that has, you know, the resources and the clarity to just make it happen because he's, you know, there's only one or two Elon Musks on Earth, you know, and So it was a very cool kind of the story, the way, like, the timeline unfolds, and Malcolm Graves is kind of just, you know, he's just kind of living through his days and through his years and not really thinking about what's going on. And I'm trying not to do any spoilers, but there's a reason that, Malcolm Graves and Zaf and the Provenio Corporation and everyone, it's not just the terrorist attack. This all becomes very, very real and very relevant to their lives. Whereas before it was just kind of a story on the news. So I thought that was a very cool way of doing it because it wasn't like the story doesn't beat you over the head with the politics of the era. It becomes real to the characters. And I thought that was also a better way to go about doing it than instead of just laying out the political climate of the year 23, whatever.
That was the main thing. Most people probably would have set their book right after the meteor. And that was my main idea. 300 years later, it's in the past and a whole new civilization has developed because of it. So it's not this dystopian world. It's, you know, a thriving civilization that's already recovered, but they've changed the way they live.
It's not post-apocalyptic and it's not dystopian. Absolutely not. Those were the two... those were red hot, you know, recently. And this book, I almost want to call it a space opera, but I don't think that's quite fair to it. I think it's actually a little bit more nuanced than that because of the noir detective angle to it and the terrorism. And there's just kind of I don't like arguing over labels and categories in general, but I would not call it post-apocalyptic because of how far removed they are from the event.
And yeah, it takes away that. Subgenres are always tough for me. I mean, especially on Amazon, you get like 10 to choose from. Sci-fi noir is not one of them. So yeah. I always try to make a blend. It's not pure space opera. It's always, or pure anything. Well, you know, try also, to mash them up a little.
Well, I guess, and I had someone when I was self-publishing one of mine, is they wanted to know what categories it fit in, and I kind of gave them two or three, and they wanted. I mean, they were. They kept wanting to put it in a box and what book is it like? You know, what bestseller is it like? And I just kept thinking, I'm like, well, does it have to fit in a neat Amazon category or resemble a bestseller to be worth reading? Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. For example, Da Vinci Code, for example, didn't resemble, I mean, I guess it resembled Indiana Jones movies, but like some of these books, like just because they don't really fit neatly into one of these subcategories doesn't mean they're not worth reading.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, on the big sites, they don't give you a lot to choose from. They only put the really popular ones on there. So it's tough. I know before it came out, me and my agent were discussing where it could fit in. And I was like, well, maybe it fits into cyberpunk because of the corporations. Yeah. But then cyberpunk usually is confined to Earth and cybernetical enhancements, so it didn't really fit with there. It's a thriller, but it's also a mystery. So I wanted to make something that was sort of a mash of genres, basically just science fiction.
Yeah, cyberpunk is more of a style. Because some people say it has to take place in computers and in virtual reality or the internet, or it has to be dark and kind of in a post-industrial, kind of like, do androids dream of electric sheep and whatever, or Matrix, for example. But really, cyberpunk is more of a style, in my opinion. I don't like to, because every time I hear people try to peg down what is cyberpunk, they never really get to a clear answer, except for that it involves computers. Yeah. That's just not really a definition for me.
Well, yeah, I've looked it up too, and there's like cyberpunk, but it's sort of expanded pretty far. So there's different like subgenres of cyberpunk as a subgenre. So it's definitely tough to pin down, and that's why we weren't sure if Titanborn fit, because there was no focus on those themes of technology sort of taking over human life, day-to-day human life, or the corporate powers and Earth. It was sort of just a little bit of those elements in it and a whole lot of other stuff. So it was, yeah, definitely tough to pin down subgenre.
Yeah, I think we need to, as a whole franchise, or I'm sorry, as a whole genre, I think just in general, we need to stop getting obsessed with these subgenre labels. But that's just my kind of...
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So you said the second one is written. There's going to be three in this Titanborn. Is it going to be a trilogy and you're working on the third, or is this something that you might see extending into a series? A longer series.
Okay, so the second one, they actually announced that it'll come out in March of next year.
Oh, okay. Yeah, March 2017. All right.
And I am working on the third one. I wouldn't call it a trilogy, only because, well, the stories all connect. The second book is a whole new cast of characters. It's a totally different story. So I guess it's more of a connected series in the same universe.
Okay.
But right now I have three planned, and really they're going to take you directly to the revolution starting, which is what the next one is about. And then the third one is sort of the main fighting of the revolution has happened already. What now? Is anything really going to change? And how do all the characters that have been established who are going to be in this deal with trying to make peace with each other, or can they even ever do that? So I'm basically doing what most people wouldn't do, where a meteor hit, but I'm not writing about the future directly after that. Yeah. And a revolution's happening, and I'm sort of writing about the after effects of it rather than the actual battle.
It is. Yeah. It's kind of like George Martin and Game of Thrones, where there's a war going on, but he kind of writes around the war.
Yeah.
Excellent. So that's kind of like your work schedule, or kind of what you're working on going forward, or was there another project I think you might have been working on the side you mentioned? I don't know if that's really I forget what you described it to me a little bit, but I don't know if it's really on, is this something like it's a kind of a long-term project or
No, yes, so I actually finished recently. It's a standalone science fiction novel. So I have no plans for sequels or anything. I think it works on its own. Me and my eight, we actually sent it out today. We're sending it out to publishers.
All right. Nice.
But it's much different than what I normally write. It's not the thriller or space opera, not that fast paced like action adventure. It's more of a, I don't know. Again, we had a really tough time pinning down the subgenre, and cyberpunk is probably going to be the main subgenre, only because of the focus on technology being on Earth affecting people's lives. But it's really also utopian, and I don't want to ruin too much about it before anything's announced with it. But I like to think of it as a sort of futuristic Truman Show on a much, much grander scale.
Very cool. I did like that movie.
Yeah, so
it wasn't quite as funny as it's not quite as funny as I think they hoped it would be, but I think just the broader story was very fascinating.
Yeah, as like a science fiction movie, which is what I view it as. I think it's really relevant even more today. So I took that basic premise and really pushed it to a much darker place.
Naturally, because that's kind of the general color of your first few novels here. There's a little bit of a darker tint to these things. I actually had to watch Truman Show for a college course, and the college course was on Utopias. It was on Utopias. So
like, that's funny. I didn't even think about that. Basically, he is living in one, and this, it's the opposite. The people watching the show are the ones living in the utopia. So they're interested in watching the awful world while they live in a perfect world.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's cool. All right. I guess it's almost about time to wrap up. It's just a couple quick kind of random questions. What are you watching on TV these days? Are you into any shows right now?
On TV, I was just watching The Night Of.
I've heard good things about that.
I love that. Ray Donovan, I watched. It's the summer, so there's not that much, unfortunately. But soon Luke Cage will come out, and a couple of my favorite HBO shows. So Westworld looks really, really, really good.
Yeah, I am psyched about that. Yes.
Yeah, and The Leftovers is going to have its final season, which I think that's my favorite show on TV. So.
I've actually been getting more into some of these kind of middleweight and kind of light, you know, not really heavy shows on Sci-Fi Channel, like Dark Matter, Killjoys, and some of these others that are, you know, they're not great. As a science fiction nerd, you know, they're not really great to me, but they're kind of fun to watch. And then also, I think you told me to give the Star Wars cartoons a shot. And
yeah.
This summer I did. You know, as a grown man, there's a lot of these. I am a Star Wars fan, so of course, you know, there's a part of me that is excited about it. But at the same time, a lot of the show is basically for kids. But I ended up agreeing with you, though, that at first I thought, I was wondering, what the hell did you get me into when I was watching Clone Wars? I'm like, this is a ridiculous show. But by season three, it started to get a lot more serious and try to reach a little farther. And I thought it was actually kind of a cool way of introducing a new generation of kids that probably never saw, you know, to them the original movies or some old fashioned movie, you know, they wouldn't care to see it. And I also watched Star Wars Rebels, which I think is, again, I mean, there's parts of it that are a lot of fun, and then there's parts of it that are clearly just for kids. And I get a little annoyed that they take something that is a, you know, in the movies, a very serious thing, and they turn it into kind of a fun little game. So, but at the same time, that's what I've been watching recently, cartoons. Yeah, no,
I think, especially with Clone Wars, they did a really good job of sort of making it accessible for kids, and as it went along, making sure they keep their adult audience by getting more serious with their themes throughout. I hope Rebels does the same thing, which, based on the trailers for the upcoming season, it looks like it will. They're bringing in one of the best Star Wars villain in all of the expanded universe. So it should be really good.
I'm wondering, though, because of what we know of what happens in the movies, that Luke Skywalker is the last Jedi in Return of the Jedi. So if this is canon, every single Jedi in the show has to die within the next 5 to 10 years.
And that's But yeah, I don't anticipate a good ending for Ezra, the main character.
I don't either. And I'm wondering how they're going to handle that. You know, like, what are they going to
do? I don't see a happy ending for him.
I don't see one for Kanan either. I don't think he's going to be around. It just has to be.
No,
they all have to die. Like, saga.
Did you ever read the Thrawn Star Wars books, which is the character they're bringing back?
I know about him. I did not. Those books are on my to read list, along with the new canon books that they're putting out, New Dawn, and the new book about Ahsoka. So it is on my list, but I did not read them. But I did look up a little bit of information on on Wookiepedia.org. That's where I've been going to kind of figure out, because I don't know the expanded universe very well. So whenever these things pop up in Rebels or in Clone Wars, or what might pop up in Rogue One, I was like, okay, I don't want to go in this and not know what I'm talking about. So I've been starting to do some research. And Thrawn looks like a very fascinating villain. And I'm kind of very curious to see how they do this. And I am pissed off that Darth Maul is around. I think that's ridiculous. I am glad that Thrawn is going to probably be the primary antagonist.
And yeah, well, Maul should be dead. Sorry. I think when it comes to Darth Maul, they realize they made a huge mistake by killing him off to begin with.
First movie is a problem. Yeah, I agree. But that first movie is a problem. But to bring him back the way they did, he was cut in half and he fell a long way down. He's dead. So I just don't like that they brought him back.
But they could throw aside anything like that by just saying strong in the Force these days. So.
But hopefully
Thrawn brings that sort of genius intensity that he has in those books, because it'll be fun to see on a show if they make him the same way he was in those books and don't tone down his brilliance, because he was a much more efficient leader than Darth Vader.
I could see that. Do you, I just had a question on that. All right. Season 2 spoiler for Rebels real quick. Do you think Ahsoka is dead?
No. There's no, they wouldn't kill her off screen. That'd be silly.
You know what? Because of the Maul thing and the fact that it was off screen, I do agree with you that they can't do it, but just from what I know about the universe and Darth Vader, she should be dead. But again, you're right. They probably can't do that.
But you also have to, this is earlier on. So he still, I know in the new canon books, they sort of always allude to the fact that he isn't totally a shell of his former self yet. There's a little bit of memory of things that have happened in the past. Whereas by episode 4, that's completely gone.
Yeah.
So who knows, especially with Ahsoka, because she's not in the movies. I mean, that's something specific to the characters in the animated shows.
Well, there is a way for her to be alive in 4, 5, and 6 because she's not Jedi. Because yes. Yoda's declaration in Return of the Jedi is that Luke is the last one. That means there has to be, and Yoda would know. So by that movie, Luke has to be the last one. But Ahsoka is not Jedi, so she could technically survive the Rebels show. So I guess, yeah, they could do that, and they could build up a whole little kind of branch of rebellion stories around her, and she never crosses paths with Luke. You know, it may not mean she doesn't
She could be in Rogue One, but the only reason I don't think they'll do that is because they're not going to cater to the small audience that watches these shows. Because by putting her into the movie, they'd have to explain where she comes from, everything. I don't know if they have time to introduce that many characters, but it would be really cool to see her appear.
I checked on IMDb. She's not listed, but that doesn't mean officially she's not in it, but that means it's very unlikely.
Well, I would guess they'd hope that they would put her in as a code name as to not spoil it.
Yeah, that's possible. I'm also kind of wondering, I keep trying to guess who Snoke is, and I keep feeling like something in Rogue One might drop a hint, but it doesn't have to, of course. But I was like, well, maybe if Disney was really the master marketing empire that they are sometimes, maybe they drop Snoke's origins into either Rogue One or Rebels without telling you it's Snoke, but kind of drop who it really is and tie it to episode 8 and 9 later on.
Yeah, no, I hope they've done that. Although the latest theory I saw was someone saying he was Darth Maul, so that would be kind of stupid. I think I personally still think the biggest chances for him to be Darth Sidious is old master, but who knows what they're going to do.
Yeah, my two favorites so far. One is that he is an old apprentice of Darth Vader, either Starkiller or Galen Merrick or Galen whatever from the video game. I figured if they take a Vader apprentice, that would make a lot of sense because he's devoted to Vader even after death. That was one that I thought made a lot of sense. Plagueis, but I guess that's a possible one. And then
he did discover immortality, so.
True. Yeah.
That's the only reason why I think he makes sense.
Yeah, and the other was either an ex-inquisitor, which isn't big enough, and isn't just isn't scary enough. Snoke has to be a big deal, so I would imagine
he. Yeah, it has to be someone mentioned in the movies, I would think.
Yeah, so I guess Maul would be interesting. That because I don't know what happens to his species once they reach a certain age. Maybe the horns fall off, and that's what happens. I don't know. That'd be a cool one. So, all right, well, should probably leave it there. We're at the hour mark here, so I should check out. But Rhett, thank you for joining me and talking about your book.
Thank you for having me.
But that'll do it for this episode. Thank all of you for listening and joining us, and until next time.